Welcome to Celebrate Poe, episode 230, To Be or Not. When I was a little boy, my parents told me that we were going on the train. My father was a railroad conductor and got free train tickets. And one time we went to see Richard Burton, or should I say Sir Richard Burton, in Shakespeare's Hamlet on Broadway. Of course, at that time, I was bored to tears by the play. Again, I was just a little boy, and I was far more excited by the train ride to New York itself. I thought the play Hamlet would never end, so you can imagine my feelings at the end of Act One when I realized that there was another full act to come. It seemed to go on and last forever. But when Richard Burton gave the To Be or Not to Be soliloquy, I felt chills going up and down my spine, even as a kid. Of course, at the time, I had no idea that I was in the presence of greatness. Well, my original intention was to look at the use of various concepts of time in some of Shakespeare's plays today, and while there is no direct evidence to suggest that William Shakespeare was explicitly familiar with the Greek terms chronos and kairos, Shakespeare's extensive knowledge of classical literature, including works by ancient Greek and Roman authors, is well documented. Now, let me intersperse something right here. The term kairos, beginning with the K, K-A-I-R-O-S, is pronounced kairos, kind of like you're starting to say Cairo. But I've heard the word chronos pronounced as chronos and kraunos, and I think I've used both pronunciations in this podcast. But the correct way to pronounce chronos is chronos, C-H-R-O-N-O-S, chronos. Or, chronos, right, chronos. Think of the blackbird crows. Okay, crows, chronos. Okay, I'll try to stick to that one and pronounce the word as chronos. Think of the crows, chronos. Hopefully that somehow impressed it on your mind, if it didn't make a great deal of sense or whatever. Shakespeare lived during the Renaissance, a period marked by a revival of interest in classical literature. The works of ancient Greek and Roman writers were studied and translated during this time. While the direct use of the words chronos, there I said it right, while the direct use of chronos and kairos in Shakespeare's plays or writings is not explicitly evident, the concepts represented by these terms were certainly part of the intellectual environment of the Renaissance. Now, I'm an interpreter for the deaf, an American Sign Language interpreter who specializes in interpreting Shakespeare in American Sign Language. And I think it might be helpful to at least talk about the thought process behind signing to be or not to be for the deaf, just the first 10 words, not the entire soliloquy. Now, in American Sign Language, or ASL, the vocabulary is naturally different because you're using what is essentially a different language. In fact, there are no ASL words for to be or not to be, that is the question. That's 10 English words, but there are no exact equivalents in ASL. So how you sign that specific line depends on your interpretation of the concepts. So I signed the sign for life to signify to be on one side of the body, then death on the other side of the body to signify not to be. followed by which, signifying that there is a choice or decision that the actor is contemplating, and that the sign for which shows that choice and that it's being made or needs to be made. In other words, I believe the soliloquy delves deeply into a contemplation of life and death as two choices and is an exploration of existence. And furthermore, when analyzing this soliloquy through the lens of Chronos and Kairos, two distinct concepts of time, we can uncover deeper layers of meaning within Hamlet's introspection. Now, as I hope you know by now, Chronos refers to chronological or sequential time, the measurable and linear progression of events. In the soliloquy, Hamlet contemplates the hardships and struggles that come with life, portraying a sense of enduring time and the burdens that it carries. An example of Chronos are the lines in which Hamlet reflects on the troubles that individuals face throughout their lives, such as the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. This seems to highlight the ongoing challenges that people encounter over time. Kairos, now remember again, that's K-A-I-R-O-S, on the other hand, represents an opportune moment or qualitative aspect of time, emphasizing the significance of the present moment. Within the soliloquy, Hamlet grapples with the idea of seizing an opportunity for change or action. An instance of Kairos can be seen when Hamlet ponders whether it is nobler to endure life's struggles or take action against them, contemplating the opportune moment to make a decision that could literally alter his life. The problem is, and we see this over and over and over in the play, is that Hamlet cannot make the right time to act or make a decision. And by not making a decision, he is, in essence, making a decision. Hamlet seems to be always wrestling with doubt and the desire for absolute certainty before taking action. I've heard before the play described as the story of a man who can't make up his mind. Well, unfortunately, Hamlet's indecision allows Claudius to solidify his power and potentially plot against Hamlet. This reinforces the importance of recognizing and seizing Kairos moments when they arise. And I'm sure that we've all put off making a decision until what we feel is exactly the right moment, only to find that the time for effective action has passed. In other words, Hamlet seeks a Kairos moment, a moment of perfect timing and absolute proof of Claudius, his father-in-law's guilt. This internal struggle between the pressure of immediate action, Chronos, and the search for the right moment, Kairos, drives much of the play's conflict. Other examples of Chronos time in Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be soliloquy, though they may not seem specific at first, can be found in his reflections on the enduring struggles and challenges of life that happen regularly. For example, when Hamlet mentions the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune in the soliloquy, he is alluding to the outgoing adversities and misfortunes that we all as individuals face throughout our lives. Some scholars believe that this reference encapsulates the idea of Chronos time by highlighting the continuous nature of life's hardships and the enduring burden that they impose on individuals as they navigate through life. Another example of Chronos in the soliloquy is when Hamlet contemplates the whips and scorns of time, emphasizing the relentless passage of time and its impact on individuals as they endure the trials and tribulations that inevitably come with it. And during Shakespeare's time, those trials and tribulations seem to occur like clockwork. The structure of Hamlet's To Be or Not to Be speech is characterized by a unique and reflective form that delves deep into existential contemplation. Many critics believe the soliloquy stands out as atypical compared to other monologues in Shakespeare's works because it's entirely dedicated to introspection and reflection. The soliloquy is a moment of deep reflection for Hamlet, where he contemplates the fundamental questions of life and death. It is devoid of direct action or interaction with other characters, focusing solely on Hamlet's internal musings. And unlike typical soliloquies that provide answers or insights into the character's motives, Hamlet's soliloquy spreads doubts rather than offering clarity. The doubts and uncertainties expressed by Hamlet even extend to the audience, both in audiences during Shakespeare's time as well as modern audiences, creating a sense of questioning and doubt. Hamlet's thoughts unfold gradually in a process of seeking, reflecting, and associating ideas. The opening line, "To be or not to be," sets the tone for a series of contemplations and questions that continue throughout the soliloquy. Various grammatical structures are employed in the soliloquy, including a series of infinite forms like to suffer, to take arms, to say, to lie, to sleep, among others. These structures contribute to the deliberative and contemplative nature of Hamlet's speech. The soliloquy delves into such themes as the struggle between existence and non-existence, the burdens of life, the fear of the unknown after death, societal injustices, and the complexities of human existence. Overall, the structure of Hamlet's soliloquy in the To Be or Not to Be speech is characterized by its reflective nature, lack of resolution, sequential thought processes, use of diverse grammatical structures, and exploration of profound existential themes. Most critics believe that the purpose of Hamlet's soliloquy in the play is multifaceted and essential to the development of the character, the plot, and the overall atmosphere of the play for a variety of reasons. Hamlet actually has 7 soliloquies in the play, but it is generally felt that the To Be or Not to Be soliloquy is the most important in his development, and many of the characteristics of the other 6 soliloquies are also reflected in this To Be or Not to Be speech. Hamlet's soliloquies, especially To Be or Not to Be, provide a direct insight into his innermost thoughts, emotions, and struggles. They offer a glimpse into his true self, revealing his complex character beyond what is shown in interactions with other characters. Throughout his soliloquies, Hamlet's character is developed and portrayed in a more profound manner. The soliloquies showcase his introspection, doubts, fears, and contemplations, allowing the audience to understand the depth of his internal struggles and conflicts, and making decisions at the appropriate time. Each soliloquy contributes to advancing the plot by shedding light on Hamlet's motives, decisions, and state of mind. They serve as a narrative device that propels the story forward, while providing crucial insights into Hamlet's actions and responses. The soliloquies help create a specific atmosphere within the play by immersing the audience in Hamlet's emotional turmoil and existential contemplations. They add depth and complexity to the overall tone of the play. Specifically, Hamlet's soliloquies, particularly the To Be or Not to Be speech, reflect the theme of madness in the play through a complex portrayal of Hamlet's most inner turmoil and conflicting emotions. Let me explain. Hamlet's soliloquies unveil his profound mental struggles, showcasing his inner conflicts, doubts, and emotional turmoil. The soliloquies provide a glimpse into the complexities of his mind, highlighting his descent into madness, or his feigned madness, as a strategic ploy. I mean, never underestimate the fact that he could be acting mad. In other words, they point at the possibility that Hamlet might be, again, faking that madness. The soliloquies depict Hamlet's emotional instability and erratic behavior, reflecting his internal chaos and psychological distress following the traumatic events in his life. These emotional outpourings contribute to the perception of his madness. And the soliloquies also blur the lines between Hamlet's feigned madness, if that's the case, and a potential genuine descent into insanity. They create ambiguity around whether his actions are part of a calculated plan or a manifestation of true mental instability, adding layers to the theme of madness in the play. Hamlet's soliloquies serve as a tool for character development, showcasing the evolution of his mental state and the impact of external events on his psyche. They reveal the internal conflicts that drive his actions and decisions throughout the play. In essence, Hamlet's soliloquies provide a crucial role in reflecting the theme of madness by delving into his inner struggles, emotional turmoil, existential contemplations, and the blurred lines between sanity and insanity. These introspective monologues offer a window into Hamlet's complex psyche and contribute significantly to the portrayal of madness within the play. The character of Hamlet exhibits signs of mental distress, such as depression and melancholy, which are evident in his soliloquies and actions throughout the play. Analyses propose that Hamlet's condition could be attributed to a depressive illness, potentially in combination with episodes of mania that align with symptoms of bipolar disorder. While Hamlet's behavior includes elements of feigned madness for strategic purposes, there are indications that he may genuinely suffer from mental illness. His struggles with grief, existential contemplation, and the pressures of avenging his father's death contribute to his deteriorating mental state. The soliloquies reveal his inner turmoil and contemplation of life and death, reflecting a mind in distress. Overall, while Hamlet's portrayal involves elements of both feigned and potentially genuine madness, and interpretations vary regarding the extent to which he can be considered mentally ill, the fact remains that the character's complex psyche, emotional struggles, and erratic behavior contribute to a nuanced depiction that blurs the lines between sanity and insanity within the context of the play. Whew! Even though most common mental illnesses were not given a name until centuries after Shakespeare's death, Shakespeare wrote many would consider extremely accurate accounts of individuals with many common mental illnesses of today. Of course, the names weren't given, but the symptoms were. That's a very good way of saying it. Shakespeare described the symptoms. Some of those mental illnesses that Hamlet's behavior could be linked to include borderline personality disorder, or BPD, personality disorder is characterized by difficulties in controlling emotions, unstable mood swings, impulsivity, poor self-image, and stormy relationships. Well, Hamlet certainly has those. His emotional instability, impulsive actions, and struggles with relationships aligned with the symptoms of borderline personal disorder. than bipolar disorder. A bipolar disorder involves several mood swings between manic and depressive episodes. Hamlet's constantly fluctuating moods, from moments of intense melancholy to periods of heightened energy and agitation, resonate with the symptoms of bipolar disorder. I personally have seen performances of Hamlet where the actor playing the lead role of Hamlet was at one moment very, very depressed, then a few minutes later was extremely excited, and he used that interpretation to end up totally out of control by the end of the play. Or there are signs in the play of Hamlet with a major depressive disorder. Well, major depressive disorder is basically marked by persistent feelings of sadness, hopelessness, and loss of interest in activities. In other words, they really wouldn't get excited about anything. Hamlet's profound grief over his father's death, his contemplation of suicide, and his overall pessimistic outlook on life reflect symptoms of a major depressive disorder. And schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a lasting mental disorder characterized by impaired thought processes and emotional responses. Some interpretations suggest that Hamlet's erratic behavior, hallucinations, and struggles with reality could be indicative of schizophrenia. And finally, dissociative identity disorder, or DID. Dissociative identity disorder involves the presence of two or more distinct personality states within an individual. While not as commonly discussed in relationship to Hamlet, some scholars suggest that his complex character and internal conflicts could be associated with dissociative identity disorder. Well, let me conclude with the actual words of to be or not to be. There's some incredible, incredible videos of gray actors performing this speech. I have the URL to a video of Sir Richard Burton performing the to be or not to be soliloquy on YouTube at the top of the transcript for this episode on the website celebratepoe.buzzsprout.com. That's celebratepoe.buzzsprout.com. But I'm going to go ahead and conclude with me reading the to be or not to be soliloquy, the beginning. Not to compete with some of the greats on YouTube, such as Richard Burton, Sir Laurence Olivier, Kenneth Branagh, Benedict Cumberbatch, and Kenneth Branagh, none of those greats. But if you don't have access to YouTube at the moment, hopefully this will just have to do and relate some of those lines. To be or not to be. That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die. To sleep. No more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep. To sleep. Perchance to dream, aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come, when we have suffered off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of deprived love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns the patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin. Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that dread of something after death, the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear these ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus conscience doth make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sickled o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment with this regard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. Join Celebrate Poe for episode 234, More Than Love, where I delve into the uses of Chronos and Kairos and even dreams in the works of William Shakespeare. Sources include Hamlet by William Shakespeare. Thank you for listening to Celebrate Poe.